Angeles. We're now on season 2, episode 26 of this podcast, and this time we'll be discussing an interesting topic about infodemic and misinformation. For today's podcast episode, we have invited once again Dominic Doc Liger, a seasoned data analytics professional from Cyrilytics and Data Ethics Philippines, as he shares with us his valuable insights on the truth behind the lies and propaganda regarding fake news and disinformation, as well as its significant influence to our digital economy. So let's get started. Thank you for listening to FinCircle and welcome to our podcast. Fake news, defined by the researchers as stories debunked by 6 major fact-checking services, can spread 10 times faster than legitimate news stories, according to the study by researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. The researchers studied rumors spread on Twitter between the service's launch in 2006 and 2017. While some US lawmakers and other critics have blamed automated bots for the spread of fake news before the 2016 election, the MIT researchers filtered out tweets spread by bots for their study. The researchers found out that false news not only spread faster than true stories, but it also had much wider reach, according to the study. The top 1% of news cascades, the researchers word for widely spread tweets, reach between 1,000 and 100,000 people, while true information rarely reach more than 1,000 people. False news diffuse significantly farther, faster, broader, deeper in every category of information. Study confirmed by Simon Arnold, the management professor at MIT. The research team broke down news into different categories: politics, business, natural disasters, among others. And in all categories, false news spread farther and faster than true news. and sometimes by an order of magnitude, according to Arrow. And false political news spread the fastest, however. The team studied more than 4.5 million tweets in 126,000 news cascades. And the researchers used two state-of-the-art bot detection services to filter out tweets spread by bots. The team found out that bots do accelerate the spread of fake news, but they also accelerate the spread of true news at about the same rate. Bots cannot explain the massive difference between how fast and far and deeply and broadly false news spreads compared to the truth, he said. Human beings are responsible for that. The researchers didn't investigate whether people spreading false news were doing it maliciously or because they believe it was true. They found that people spreading fake news generally had fewer followers and tweeted less often than those sharing legitimate news stories. So false news spread faster and farther even with the handicap of being trafficked by less experienced Twitter users. And people who spread fake news may do so because of its novelty and because they may gain status by sharing new information. According to him, novel information is more valuable than information you already know. Fake news is an insidious and widespread issue in the news industry as a whole and has become a global problem. In the United States, the term and concept grew in popularity during the 2016 election, but has since manifested itself in areas outside the realm of politics. The most recent example of this is the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost 80% of consumers in the United States reported having seen fake news on the coronavirus outbreak, highlighting the extent of the issue and the reach fake news can achieve. The spread of false information is hard to control, and audiences seem aware of this, with most expecting the fake news situation to worsen in the next 5 years. What many consumers may not realize, however, is that they also have a part to play in reining in or slowing the spread of made-up stories. Fake news sharing is not uncommon, and while savvier and more responsible news audiences refrain from passing on content they know to be false, this is not the case for everyone. 10% of respondents to a study admitted to having knowingly shared fake news to others, behavior which only serves to exacerbate the problem. One of the things that we have recognized is that as audiences grow more discerning and learn to swiftly differentiate between suspicious and genuine content, there is certainly hope that whilst fake news will continue to circulate, consumers will gradually pay less attention. Moreover, some analysts and consumers favor a combined approach from governments as well as the official news publications, journalists, social media networks, and influential companies which seeks to identify and eliminate fake news from the news landscape. While it's a good idea in principle, the reality of such an approach would almost certainly spark concerns about press freedom and perhaps for some other location and countries, human rights, something which is already worsening on a global scale. In the meantime, fake news will continue to be a threat, and the responsibility to restrict the spread of false content will fall mostly to the consumer and everyone who's receiving it. One of the most important things really is to recognize and basically see which wind are real and which one are not. And this is something that we need to make some effort along the way to basically figure out what is this. And education is certainly one way of doing this in the long term. In today's podcast episode, we'll be talking to Dominic Doc Ligot from Data Ethics Philippines and Serialytics as he shares with us his interesting views about infodemic and misinformation in our digital ecosystem. Thanks for joining us again, Doc, and welcome back to FinCircle.
Nice to be here, and thanks for having me again.
It's already been a few months since our last podcast conversation, Doc. Thus, I suppose there are some developments with regards to data ethics is concerned. Where are we at this stage, and which direction are we going?
Well, when we started data ethics in 2019, I think at that time, that was even before COVID became a big problem. We were already thinking about what we would be calling the dark side of data. So, for example, we are already in what is now known as the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And the Fourth Industrial Revolution is the data revolution. So in a nutshell, the difference between the Third Industrial Revolution, which is IT, and the Fourth, is in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, technologies, machines, they can become independent of humans. And that's because of data, because we're producing a lot of data. And with that data comes the use of artificial intelligence and machine learning, which allows machines and systems to perform activities independent of humans by just using data or the patterns generated from data. Of course, it still requires human beings to create these machine learning algorithms. But once they're built, and for example, in robotics or in things that we take for granted, like social media and shopping, algorithms are already being used to predict what people will do. And depending on what you do, these systems and platforms react automatically, so there's no need for humans. So that's good because it automates our lives. Things can become more efficient, but then that also carries with it its own risks. For example, in social media, algorithms are trained to highlight content that encourages people to be more engaged. So the artificial intelligence in Facebook, for example, is one that encourages people to like and share, say, content and posts amongst your friends. But then what if, based on the data, the content that is more likely to be shared is harmful content, like fake news or disinformation? The algorithm doesn't distinguish between good and bad information. They're just trained to optimize engagement. And that's why we now have a problem with fake news on Facebook or in social media. So that's, I think, just one of many issues that we were starting to notice. And back in 2019, we thought, no one is talking about this, or very few. Everyone you meet who is into AI and machine learning and data would talk a lot about the benefits of it to society. While we, at least my colleagues, when we started Data Ethics, we were thinking there needs to be a conversation and a discourse about the dangers of data. At the same time, we also wanted to recognize people using data for the benefit of society, because a lot of the discussions around data as well were generally business oriented. So people using it for profit, people using it for commercial purposes, which is not a good or a bad thing. I mean, people need to make money. But then there's also an equal I'd probably say more important story where a lot of the social problems we have today, like public health, COVID, for example, climate, these are issues that also have a data component, and no one talks about that too. So, I mean, in a nutshell, when we formed Data Ethics, we centered on two mantra for our group. One mantra is data rights are human rights. So we want people to understand that their lives, our lives, in the fourth industrial revolution are now driven by data. And what happens to our data effectively affects our lives. And then the second mantra as well is social problems are data problems. So if we look at all of the social issues we face today, most likely you'll find a data issue there. And people need to be made aware that if we learn how to use data for good, we also learn how to fix what's wrong with our society. So these are the two big imperatives that drove us to start Data Ethics. And well, we're almost 2 years into it. And I think since 2019, I would imagine the public awareness, and that's not just because of us. I mean, it's like simultaneously the public awareness became heightened about all of the issues related to data. Like Facebook, for example, discrimination, even data privacy. These are now part of our social concerns, and that's what data ethics is all about.
It has been observed that one of the significant challenges of data is related to quality and scarcity. How do you think this can be mitigated?
Well, yeah, data quality first. I think what people also neglect. Number one, it's counterintuitive that data quality affects us deeply. But, you know, little things like, you know, inaccurate information on, let's say, your ID or your tax records or your credit card bills can cause a big problem to your life, right? And then at the same time, related to data quality is, I'd say, the security of the data. A lot of our transactions, especially since the pandemic started, have now shifted online. So you transact business online. People study online. They go to work online. And whenever you're doing online work, your data is also getting exposed. And if that gets stolen or affected by, let's say, an independent agent, it could also cause a lot of trouble for you, your livelihood, your financials. So these are all, I would say, part of this whole big issue on making data more useful, but making sure it doesn't become harmful to you. Then you also talked about the scarcity. I think that is a more fundamental problem, because I think you can divide the world nowadays and people in society between those who are data rich and data poor. So it's almost very similar now to, you know, the rich and poor divide financially. Data is its own currency. So in areas where people are living in a data rich society, they also get to reap the benefits of that. But at the same time, there are parts of society which are data poor, and it becomes exponentially harder for people who don't have access to data or who don't even have basic data about themselves to also access the benefits of society. Like a specific issue I can cite here, especially in the Philippines, I've been to Mindanao, the island of Mindanao recently. There are people in Mindanao who don't even have birth certificates. It's something you take for granted. And if you don't have a birth certificate, you probably don't have a passport. And if you don't have a passport and you don't have all these other IDs, how do you open a bank account? And if you don't have a bank account, how do you earn a salary? You know, it starts with a data problem, like a lack of a birth certificate, and it exponentially becomes a social crisis, a social issue. Whereas on the other side of, you know, society,
like for those of us who living in the capital, we take all of that for granted. You know, we're accessing our social media accounts online, doing credit card transactions. We kind of forget that it's data that makes all of this possible. So that's an important thing to remember when we're talking about data scarcity. Or there's a term we're trying to propagate, which is called data poverty. You know, the lack of data now becomes a hindrance to you living in society. And in many ways, it's exactly the same as, you know, financial poverty.
What are the differences and similarities about infodemic and misinformation?
So, okay, maybe we'll tackle the disinformation definition first. So you have false information or information that isn't true. And I think you can divide the definition into whether the spread of that information was intentional and malicious or not. So for example, you read someone's post about, let's say, about vaccines, and it looks legitimate. It comes from a source that you feel is reputable. It's a scientific journal, and you share it to your friends. And later you find out that journal is actually, not really reputable, or that paper was retracted. So you can be said to be misinformed. That's misinformation. On the other hand, there's cases when people deliberately share wrong information to deceive people or to engage in propaganda. So they might be using the exact same thing you shared, but it was intentional to deceive and mislead people, or you might have been a victim of that deception. So that subtle difference in intent, the moment it becomes malicious and intentional, then it becomes disinformation. And then there's a third definition, apart from those two, where false information and sometimes true information is also deliberately shared to attack someone. There's a term in cybersecurity called doxing, for example. When you're doxed, that means your private information was leaked to the public, or some confidential information that compromises your reputation is leaked to the public. Like, people whose nude photos were stolen and leaked to attack their reputation, for example. So that's an example of malinformation, where the truth and lies are mixed together to attack someone. So you have disinformation, which is maliciously shared wrong information, misinformation, which is accidentally or innocently shared by people who think it was true. And then you have malinformation, where both true and wrong information is mixed together and shared publicly to attack someone. And then you have infodemic. So the infodemic, it's a new term, as far as we're concerned, to describe this deluge of info, particularly around social media. So for example, let's take COVID-19. I think people kind of forget that COVID-19, apart from being the first global pandemic we've experienced since the Spanish flu, it's also the first global epidemic we've experienced during a time of social media. So before COVID, there was SARS, for example, and SARS wasn't as global as COVID. And actually, SARS, if I'm not mistaken, happened around 2002, which predates the popularity of Facebook. I think Facebook and other platforms wouldn't be hitting the market until well into 2005 or 2006. So people are now experiencing an epidemic on two fronts. There's the health side, which is COVID. And then there's also this epidemic of info, a lot of information, some of it false, some of it true. Like, for example, you have doctors and scientists sharing their views on Facebook. And you have the public who may not be trained or may not be knowledgeable in health or epidemiology, getting exposed to all these scientific papers. It's just too much info. Now, why is it called an infodemic? Well,
more recent research, and we've done some of this research as well in Cyrilytics and data ethics, is showing that information, especially online, behaves similarly to epidemics, like viral and bacterial epidemics. You have people who share it, and you can call them like carriers of the infodemic, similarly to people who are positive with the virus. They also spread that virus. People can also get infected with an infodemic. So they start once the moment they receive the information, they start resharing it themselves and it spreads. And you can map the spread of that. Let's say a Facebook post, you can trace it online, similarly to how you do contact tracing in COVID. And then at the same time, when you analyze the makeup or the composition of fake news, let's say you analyze the words, the phrases, maybe hashtags, the way the information changes online. So whenever you share something online, some people add a thing or two or deduct a thing or two. So as information is shared, it also mutates and changes, similar to how a virus mutates or a bacterium evolves. And you can analyze that mutation, similar to how geneticists analyze the mutation of a virus. So this is all very recent developments. And well, the implication is, similarly to how you should protect yourself from getting exposed to COVID, people should also protect themselves from getting exposed to infodemics of fake news. And it's also, interestingly, there's already literature showing that it is possible to get inoculated or vaccinated against fake news. So the moment you see examples of something you read online, and the moment you find out that it's exposed to be fake or false, people become more careful about sharing information. So in a way, they become vaccinated or inoculated. So I think the important thing is, how do you make people aware that, hey, look, don't just share everything you see online, even if you think it's reputable. Double check, do some fact checking. So I think that's kind of what makes infodemics kind of one of the crises, of our times. It's, I think, a symptom of the fourth industrial revolution. I don't think we've ever been in a time when we're all exposed to all of this information simultaneously, and everyone has the ability to share it as powerfully as traditional media. So you don't have to work in a news organization or a magazine to propagate messages. You can just go online and share it. And if you have a wide enough network, and if it becomes viral enough, even the term viral, you notice, it comes from virology, but it's being used to describe posts or trends that become highly popular. So when you say something is viral, in the same way a pandemic or a disease can be also a viral trend. So very, very similar characteristics.
The troll and sock puppets are becoming prevalent, particularly on social media. What do you think are being done to address the proliferation of these anonymous accounts?
Well, first we have to wonder if anything is really being done. I would argue the prevalence of trolls is actually a feature, not a bug, of social media. Facebook and Twitter allow them to proliferate, and I'll explain why. You know, to their credit, although more recent developments have heightened the scrutiny. So nowadays, it's actually very hard to open social media accounts now without valid identification. But once upon a time, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners may have done it, it's very easy to open a second or a third account and put in instead of an actual profile photo of you, you can put a picture of a cat or a cartoon character. People do this every time. I think what makes these phenomena an issue now is precisely because of things like infodemics and disinformation. And you can engineer a viral trend if you control enough accounts. And that's actually been shown, where you have click farms
and account farms that exist all over the world, where you have companies that actually take the effort to open multiple social media accounts, because this can be a source of money. So where am I headed with this? I think one of the big realizations for the public is that social media isn't this fun, free place where you can open an account, link up with your friends, and share photos anymore. It's actually a business. So Facebook and Twitter and all these social media accounts, they are actually marketing companies. So the users of that service, ironically, isn't the people opening the accounts. It's advertisers. So companies who want to sell merchandise or products and services, they would go to the Facebooks and the Twitters to promote their product. And what Facebook and Twitter offer are the audiences of people who have already opened accounts. So there's this saying, if you're not paying for a product, it probably means you are the product. So all of us who are on social media, we are the product being sold by Facebook. And that is why trolls, I think, are a feature. They are tolerated because, one, they encourage advertising spending. Because if a company basically pays a cost per click or a cost per share for their content, and the more you have these troll accounts, the more you'll have clicks and sharing. The problem is it no longer indicates, I would say, authentic behavior online. In fact, there's a term that Facebook uses called CIB, coordinated inauthentic behavior. That's their term for all of these engineering being done on their platform, and they've written extensive, prohibitions in terms of service about it. But by and large, it's actually part of their business model. It encourages spending on the platform. And then there's also, again, the unintended consequence, because Facebook allows advertisers to target people online based on demographics, where you live, what you're interested in. Your social life is now a data source for Facebook to allow them to categorize you. And that has very serious social and privacy issues, I would think, attached to it. Because if you can now be targeted based on what you believe, what you think, who you are, that is, by definition, systematic discrimination. But let's not kid ourselves. This thing has been done way before Facebook existed. So whenever, for example, companies would do advertising on the television, for example, or via email campaigns, they actually buy lists of people from companies that aggregate that information. So back before Facebook, you had telemarketing, you had email marketing. And then on TV, mass media had the same intent. They would air shows on TV, for example, targeted at specific demographics. Like, that's why you had this term called prime time. That would be the time in the day where most people are watching their favorite shows on TV. And why would they do that? And some of them even spend to produce these shows. And the reason for that is advertising. So if I'm an advertiser and I want to target a certain kind of demographic, like mothers or old senior citizens, I would buy advertising block time during shows that correspond with those audiences. So this is a kind of an old practice already. I think what Facebook, social media, especially Facebook, has done is they've made the targeting so precise, and it's now not just shows you watch, but basically what you share online is the basis for targeting. So, advertisers don't need to know which shows are trending and which shows are rating nowadays. They can just ask Facebook, give me anyone who's interested in cotton candy because I want to sell chocolates to them. And if you happen to share cotton candy on your newsfeed, then you are being targeted by these ads. So it's an invasion of privacy in the most micro level. And the sad part about it is we all
generally agreed to allow Facebook to do it just by signing up on the platform, people never read the fine print. And that's another problem with, say, infodemics. There's just so much information and you're after all the convenience of all these platforms that you rarely spend time to read all of this stuff. And now you're caught in the system for it, basically. You can't let go of your Facebook account because it's a big part of your life. It's what connects you to a lot of people. And Facebook knows that and takes advantage of that for their advertising business.
How do we spot the fake news or false information? And what are the indicators and guides that we somehow need to be aware of?
Well, it's very hard on the surface because a lot of fake news is written in the same way as actual news. I think one of the easiest, I would say easy, I think one of the first things you have to think about is whenever you see something presented to you online, first check where it came from. Check the source. Came from your friend, came from your parents, came from your, you know, came from a stranger. So that's your first filter. Then the second is what seems to be the intent for you seeing it. Is the person sharing it for information or for fun? Or even the way, let's say, an online article is written. It might look professionally done. But then when you read between the lines, you find out, hey, it looks like this is not just news. It's opinion being shared about a person and it's attacking someone's credibility. So then you have to wonder, okay, why did this article get written? What was the intent behind it? I mean, those are some of the general high level, you know, kind of guides. If you see something being shared maliciously, it seems to be malicious. It seems to hit you in a very wrong way. It seems to make you emotional. These are clues that you might be dealing with disinformation. Then at the same time, it also helps to keep track of all of these fake news sources because there's a growing number of them. Some of them get taken down because they become too sensational. Some of them are actually become very popular, like online influencers, for example, and are known for sharing, say, conspiracy theories or fake news, etc. Especially now that people in the Philippines, for example, were about to enter an election season, there's going to be a lot of this information being recycled and pushed down via social media. But again, look at the source. Is it someone you trust? If not, then automatically write it off. But even if it's someone you trust, then look at the intent. And I think the problem with doing this process, and it's called fact-checking, is it's an extra effort. It's so much easier to just like it and share it than to read between the lines. And that's why for a growing number of, still a minority, but a growing number of people, which includes me, I'm very wary of resharing content online. Because having been a victim of fake news in the past and actually sharing fake news myself, you can see it also harms your reputation the moment the truth is exposed. So you want to minimize that damage. And then at the same time, you also see kind of the cruel system that social media is based on. It's based on manipulating your emotions. You know, you get that high or you get that hit of adrenaline and dopamine the moment someone likes what you shared. And that's why people are in constant, you know, constantly seeking affirmation online sometimes. You know, you feel good when someone reshares what you shared to them, or you feel good when someone comments and praises what you've done. And these are all part of this whole social media system that takes advantage of public behavior for engagement. And behind the scenes is data and algorithms that are, you know, looking at every behavior you do and categorizing it, sorting it, and making sure that the first thing you see is some content that you would probably engage with and probably share. That's how the system works. So you just have to be vigilant and always counter check what you read with try another source. If you read it from one media company, maybe
the other media companies say the same thing. I think the problem with people these days is when you reshare something, you are in effect taking the role of mass media yourself. You are becoming part of the news network. And in if you've worked in, if you've, you know, people who work in mainstream media, like publications or news agencies, they also have an editorial process. Whenever they put out an article, they go through a process of fact-checking and double-checking and triple-checking before they put it out. And even then, they make mistakes and they make an apology when they've shared something wrong. But the public doesn't do that. You receive information, you probably never fact-check it. You just read it. If you find it interesting, you reshare it. And if you find out later that it was probably wrong information, some people just delete the post. Very rarely do people go back online and correct and apologize for it. It's just not the normal behavior for people, and that's the problem.
Deepfakes and shallow fakes are spreading like wildfire in social media streams. Is there anything that can be done to address this particular circumstance?
Well, I guess you can consider deepfakes. And again, for maybe stepping back a bit for people who are not familiar with the term. So deepfake is, the term comes from deep learning and fake video or fake photos. So you have a deepfake. Deep learning is a type of machine learning that allows you to ingest a large amount of information and produce new types of information. For example, if you ingest enough videos of Barack Obama, a deep learning algorithm called GANs, Generative Adversarial Networks, these are machine learning processes where if you've ingested enough videos, let's say of Barack Obama, you can now recreate new video of Barack Obama, but basically creating a virtual puppet. And it's no longer just video and photos, it's audio as well. You can deepfake someone's voice, you can deepfake someone's you know, accent. So you can literally create fake humans and tell them what to do, and they'll do it. Now, that technology, apart from it's a scientific wonder, you know, how this is being done, is no different from traditional computer generated imagery, CGI. But the difference is in deepfakes is much cheaper to produce. And it can be done with, you know, any normal modern laptop nowadays. You don't need very high-tech equipment for it. So objectively speaking, it's like CGI. There's nothing wrong with it per se. You know, it's another media tool that you can use. I think the problem now comes from the intent. Again, going back, why do people use deepfakes? Most of the deepfakes I've seen are more for comedic or satirical purposes. You want to get George Bush to say something stupid, or Barack Obama to, you know, say hi to your friends. It's all well and good, and you might even be using it for creative use. Like you might be a video editor, or you're a content producer, and you can use deepfakes to kind of alter the likenesses of the, let's say, the people in your video to make it suit your creative objective. So as a creative tool, it's a fantastic tool and very cost-effective. But then if you mix deepfakes with disinformation, and you're now using deepfakes to impersonate politicians, for example, and getting them to say things that are not true, or making them make absurd claims, and then passing off that video as fact, then you've now created a weapon of mass destruction, if you think about it. You have now given people the ability to systematically produce fake news that is so convincing that I am actually very, very positive that it won't be long when video evidence no longer is as reliable as it is today, because you can then produce a deep fake of someone doing something that is so hard to distinguish from real life that, you know, putting it in court invalidates its purpose as evidence. So it's spreading like wildfire because it is very compelling. Video is usually one of the highest engaged content on social media. Is there anything being done to address the issue? I think people are, in fact, encouraging the use of deepfakes. So it's really more the question of, is there anything being done to spot deepfakes being used for disinformation? And there have been a number of, calls for concern. There have been competitions, for example, hosted by Google and Facebook and even Microsoft on creating algorithms that can detect deepfakes. But I think by and large, there isn't anything really being done to stop the spread. I don't know if people know this, but one of the first places where deepfakes became popular is in the pornography industry. people could use these algorithms to superimpose like faces of their favorite actors and actresses on, you know, generic nude bodies. And so if you want to see, for example, you know, a nude video of your favorite Avenger or your favorite actress, you can just get any generic porn video and then use a deepfake to put the face of your favorite actress on the porn actor. And then you can use that you can even monetize that, because porn is again still remains one of the most viral and engaging content online. The internet was born, the spread of the internet was largely born by the porn industry. So again, when you look at that, is it an invasion of privacy? Could be. Could also be a reputational risk. You know, if you have your face on a porn actor, that's a reputational attack. And for people working in the creative industries, like actual actors and actresses, it can also be a violation of their commercial value, you know, because people do pay. If you're an actor or an influencer or a model, you monetize your appearance, you know, people actually pay you for how you look. But if people can now superimpose your appearance on, you know, generic bodies and get you, in theory, to do other things without your knowledge, and they monetize that, in effect, they're kind of attacking your livelihood. So these are some of the kind of the emerging issues related to deepfakes that I don't think people have actually addressed. As I said, it's no different to CGI. But for example, in Hollywood, if you were going to use the CGI likeness of, let's say, a popular actor, you pay royalties to that actor for the use of their likeness, for the use of their image. But I don't think anyone who's doing deepfakes, conventional deepfakes, pays royalties to anyone. I don't think. And it's hard to monitor it.
The vaccine hesitancy of some individuals is a repercussion of deception and false information by some influencers, which consequently leads to significant increase of fatalities for unvaccinated person, particularly with comorbidities, elderly, and even those healthy individuals, according to the recent statistics from WHO and CDC. How do you think we can leverage on the situation to sway the public perception to a different direction?
Well, I think there's several layers of this problem to unpack, and we've also done research on vaccine hesitancy. There is a big part of it that is due to disinformation. People are predisposed to believe, especially during times of crisis, we have a tendency to believe counter narratives. What does that mean? Like during COVID, for example, a lot of countries go into lockdowns. And these are unilateral restrictions being imposed by the government. And a lot of people consider that a violation of their right to movement. So we feel constrained and restricted. So any news that we read or any information that we read that challenges these unilateral restrictions, for example, even before vaccines, there's an ongoing thread that COVID is a manufactured virus. It's a tool for oppression. It was grown in a lab. And whether that's true or not, people feed on that information to express their resentment at being restricted. And there are some countries where this resentment is quite public, like the United States, for example. In other countries, depending on the nature of the society, the culture is more compliant. Okay, we'll stay home. No questions asked. But then you still feel being oppressed. In the same manner, vaccines is something also that is being unilaterally imposed on people. So this is not to say we're not even talking about whether vaccines work or not. It's just the act of forcing people to get vaccinated. People will see that as a violation of their right to choose, especially since it involves their bodies. You know, you have a personal right to decide whether somebody gets to stick a needle in your body. I mean, these are not in debate. I think what makes it complex is the fact that we are in the middle of a public health emergency, and we do need a certain number of the population to be vaccinated in order to achieve herd immunity. And these are the motivations driving these vaccine mandates. So you have it's not a war between good and evil. It's a war between two different kinds of good and the use of two different kinds of evils, if you think about it, right? And then you enter the conspiracy theory, the fake news. Because people do feel their rights are being attacked and their right to choose is being restricted. And they receive news that, hey, vaccines actually don't work as well as people say. Or worse, it actually aggravates the problem. Some people have actually died of side effects. And then it's easier for people to believe that, because then it reinforces their resistance to all these mandates and restrictions. So, okay, the question is, how do we fix this problem? Because it's many, many issues simultaneously. It's the prevalence of wrong information. It's this unilateral restriction and, I would say, violation of rights, for example. And then there is a public health emergency. I think you can err on the side of one or two, but not all. You have to, you know, find a compromise of some sort. But I think the easiest thing to influence here will be the information. People need to be made aware that vaccines actually do work. There are side effects, but they are mild compared to the risks of not getting sick, or the risks of not getting vaccinated, risks of getting sick of COVID itself. I know this from firsthand experience because I recently lost my father to COVID a couple of months ago, and he was in the middle of getting vaccinated when he got infected. I think he had one shot of one vaccine already, and unfortunately he caught the virus before he got his second shot, and he didn't make it out of the hospital. Am I angry at vaccines because my dad died? No. Do I wish he didn't die? Of course. Do I wish other people would have gotten vaccinated? Of course. But then look at it from the opposite side. People who are being forced to get vaccinated, otherwise they won't be able to get a job, or they won't be able to eat in a restaurant. That's a different type of oppression that somehow governments are starting to use just to encourage people to get vaccinated. So it's now you know, two different wrongs don't make a right. We need to convince people to get vaccinated, but we should stop forcing people and violating their rights to do it. And I mean, that's just what we need to do. Unfortunately, these decisions are being made by, you know, the powers that be. And I guess it starts with conversations like this. We need to talk more about it. We need to clarify and let people know that there's your personal good and the common good at stake as well, and lobby our governments not to be oppressive about these mandates, even if there is a public health emergency.
Election time is just around the corner, and the troll farms are gearing up to spread misleading information to influence public opinion. What do you think are the countermeasure we can do on this regard?
Well, the same way, I guess the advice against fake news is to be vigilant and critical. I think we need to be doubly vigilant and critical of anything that is political. Fun fact, at least in the Philippines, and I think it's similar for many countries, political ads are not subject to censorship. And even on Facebook, until recently, they said they would not censor political ads. And the reason for this comes from another side of human rights. We should have the freedom to express our political views. Now, I mean, traditionally, that kind of principle makes sense. But now that you have social media, now that you have algorithms, and now that you have this, you know, platforms where people can make information very viral, we need to have some level of scrutiny on anything political, because these platforms can help spread the wrong messages being done for political reasons. I mean, it's one thing to praise your candidate or praise a candidate's virtues and their strategies, but then you have the opposite side of propaganda, people sharing misinformation or disinformation, attacking another candidate. I think that's the problem. So going back are the issues. We need to be more vigilant. I don't know if social media will ever really regulate political ads and political messages as much as they should. So the caution should be on the part of the public. We are the ones who are in charge of what we view. And I think another easy solution is, despite the pandemic, let's limit also our time online. You know, that's the problem, because we've been restricted physically. More of our waking hours are spent online, you know, consuming content online, listening to these podcasts online. We should also save some time to, you know, unplug, get offline, you know, enjoy time with your family, read a book, you know, rather than, you know, just allowing all of these algorithms to force feed all of this content to us. I mean, that's really the best solution to, in a way, mitigate the spread of all this election-related disinformation.
Given your considerable experience on this subject matter, what advice will you give on our social media uses with regards to misinformation and disinformation?
I think the new way of how we should engage with media is, this should be more of an interactive approach. In other words, gone are the days when we just blindly listen to things on the radio or blindly watch things on television. It's very one way. If anything, social media has changed that. It's now two way. The interaction is, you consume content, but you're also capable of producing content, sharing content, engaging with content, liking content. So this two-way relationship adds a different, I would say, dimension. You now have power as well, as much as the producer of the content. So, but people don't recognize and exercise that power as much as they should. I think that's an opportunity for all of us. Some of us go to the extent of doing research on the problem, like, and not just, you know, formal researchers, but people. They start populating lists and sharing it with others, like, hey, look, don't patronize these links. I think that's generally a better thing than just having people blindly consume. So be an agent of change. Be an agent of information. Be an agent of truth. In the same way, there are trolls who are agents of, you know, falsehood. You can also adopt a similar stance and be kind of proactively sharing correction and actual information or clarifications on fake news that is spreading.
the platforms allow you to do that. You can form groups, you can create pages, and you can engage in open debate and engagement, or you can start producing your own content as well. And the public will judge your content, obviously, based on the quality and how you do it. But if, for example, like this podcast, we are sharing information that actually helps people, then it becomes a healthier and more objective atmosphere. I think the sad part is we have to just recognize the fact that fake news is just so viral, and people are predisposed to share that information as opposed to helpful information. So the negativity online is, I would say, carries a greater weight. But it's only because maybe the algorithm saw the negative behavior first, and therefore they encourage it. If more and more people share positive information, helpful information, and the algorithm starts seeing that, hey, look, that kind of content also trends, then you see the algorithms flip over and start helping that content. Remember, they don't distinguish, these machine learning algorithms do not distinguish between good and bad content. They just look for content that trends or content that people engage with. So if we're able to change the kind of some of the fundamental behaviors, all these algorithms will do is spot that behavior and encourage it as well. So again, I don't know if it'll ever happen when we'll have a fake news free social media. As I said, it's a feature, it's not a bug. Or there will be another type of social media that transcends the current approach. But we can certainly start building it based on what we do online. And I think that's the ultimate power that everyone has.
Very well said. Are there any initiatives that you are currently preoccupied with, Doc, that you would like to share with our podcast listening audience? And what is the easiest way to reach or contact you?
Well, obviously, one of the first places you can reach me is via Twitter. So Doc Ligot on Twitter. You can also find me on LinkedIn. I don't maintain a Facebook account, obviously, because I'm the first person to complain about privacy. So it was one of the first things I did was to just kill that Facebook account. But Data Ethics PH is on Facebook. So you can find it on Facebook at ethics.ph. And of course, my Serolytics is a research company that I founded. And we do data analysis and research, including on issues, including disinformation. In fact, we have a paper out. Maybe we can share that link to your audience when the podcast airs. So I'll make those links available. And at the same time, I think there are many initiatives now, particularly coming into election season, where netizens are banding together and forming coalitions. I suggest if you're interested in helping fight fake news, you can join some of these coalitions. Data Ethics PH itself is part of several coalitions. Maybe you might be able to join through us. Continue having the conversation. I think that is the most important thing. We have to continue educating people. I mean, disinformation infodemics is just one of many ethical problems related to data. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface on discrimination, on algorithmic justice. And of course, what's one thing you talked about earlier was data poverty and data scarcity. These are topics that also need attention as well.
So thanks so much, Doc, for sharing us your insightful views on infodemic and misinformation, as well as its critical importance in shaping the perspective of everyone on the social media platform. Wish you all the best and great success in the future.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And looking forward to another conversation with you to talk about these things. Thank you.
by Data Ethics Philippines and Serolytics. We would like to express our sincere gratitude to Dominic Doc Liggett on sharing us his remarkable perspective about infodemic and misinformation. We would like to hear from you. Share us your thoughts regarding our topics and send us a message on the Anchor Voice message box. Your message could end up on our future podcast episode. Make sure you never miss any episodes of FinCircle by clicking the subscribe button or follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Amazon Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Audible, Overcast, and Anchor.fm. You can also reach us on our website at fincircle.wordpress.com and our Facebook page at FinCircle Podcast. This concludes our podcast episode today. Thank you for listening on FinCircle. This is Ed Angeles. Let's catch up again soon. Thank you.